Call this meeting of Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee to order for March 19th. Representative Jordan, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I would move their approval.
Motion's been made to approve the minutes from the meeting of March 14th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes have been approved. We have a busy schedule here today, so hopefully we can get through this. The first bill we have on the agenda is House File 4761, Representative Stevenson's. I'll move that House File 4761 be referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Chair Stevenson. You want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very simple bill. It just makes a number of technical and minor adjustments that are necessary after passage of the cannabis bill last year. It clarifies some of our workplace testing law. The changes here are not intended to be substantive. They're intended to be clarificatory and technical. I'm happy to answer questions.
I don't see any testifiers. Yeah. But I'll ask, is there anybody that needs to testify on this bill? If not, any questions from members? Discussion. Representative? My brain just went.
Schultz.
Representative Schultz, yes. Stephens. Sergeant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Representative Stevenson. You know, this is a very important piece of legislation here, and I assume that you've been doing really good work with the stakeholders on this. I know for myself, as I've traveled the state during the course of the last year, I've heard a lot of concerns from employers, and especially in like heavy industrial types of settings. Does this help provide a little bit more framework and guidance for them so that they can ensure that the people who are operating machinery is going to help keep the other workers on site safe?
Chair Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I think that it does provide some clarity. The rules for large industrial premises have been are not changed by this bill, and they were kind of established in the cannabis bill last year that made clear that those safety sensitive positions can require people abstain from using cannabis as a condition of employment and can test to that effect, can have random testing. That's was in the bill that passed last year and is unchanged by this. As I said, this is more just to clarify in a few ancillary positions and provide some technical changes related to that. But yeah, it's an important issue to ensure that people who are working in those safety sensitive positions can have great confidence that they're in a safe work environment.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a companion bill moving simultaneously in the other body at this time, to your knowledge?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, the way that this is going to work, this bill is being heard in the Labor Committee. It's going to move to the Commerce Committee and then be incorporated in a cannabis omnibus bill that will leave the Commerce Committee next week. A companion to that bill is moving in the Senate. I don't know that they're using the same labor standalone provision strategy that we are. This was an effort to ensure that this committee, which is busy with many bills, didn't have to hear the entire cannabis omnibus bill, just needed to hear the labor provisions.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Stevenson. Knowing that there's so much that went into that piece of cannabis legislation, I'd like to work with you in the next committee stops to potentially further clarify, provide some additional guidance, and I apologize that I don't have those specifics or amendments today, but would just look forward to working with you on that to just improve those work conditions for Minnesota workers. Thanks.
Any further questions? Seeing nobody's hand jumping up, I'll renew my motion that House File 4761 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, Policy, and Policy Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 4508, Representative Jordan. And this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Jordan, if you want to make the motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 4508 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Thank you. And if you want to explain your bill.
Well, thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. This is a bill that primarily addresses issues with our Public Employee Labor Relations Act, or as you should all know by now, PELRA, and as it relates to higher education. The need for this bill was highlighted to me by my constituents who are employed at the University of Minnesota. And so I'm going to just briefly run through the main points of what this bill does, and you'll hear extensive testimony for the why in this bill from testifiers. So mandated bargaining units are the exception, not the norm. And so while some workers have found appropriate unions in the mandated bargaining units, over two-thirds of the U of M workforce is trapped in units that make little to no sense. And there is written testimony from Professors Jones and Garden, who are experts in labor, law, and history. And so nowhere else in PELRA would you find such, as I call them, Minnesota interesting bargaining units. This is not the norm for the public or the private sector. And so PELRA has rules and institutions for handling unit determination or communities of interest. They work well, and it's time for us to fix some of these bargaining units that are mandated in statute. The other thing that this bill does is student workers who are fortunate enough to not need financial aid or work study programs can join unions. However, student workers who do qualify for financial aid are barred from joining unions in PELRA. This bill addresses this fundamental inequity whereby working and middle class students have fewer labor rights than their peers. These students are often or always performing the exact same job as their peers who do not qualify for financial aid. And members, no one should be barred from having employment rights because of their parents' salaries. This provision applies beyond the University of Minnesota system. This bill is fundamentally about labor rights. U of M workers should have the same rights to join common sense unions as everyone else. And I know we've discussed PELRA continuously in this committee, but just as a reminder for members, because of the Supreme Court Janus decision, union membership is voluntary. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think we can go to testimony.
Thank you. First person I have on my list is Heather Holcomb. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is on.
Yeah, it's on.
It's on. Okay, I can hear.
But if you want to pull it a little bit closer to you so the recording.
How's that better?
That's good.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of HF 4508. I'm especially glad to be able to speak about this issue in front of my representative, Andrew Myers. Hello. My name is Heather Holcomb. I am a lecturer in English and the vice president of the University of Minnesota chapter of the American Association of University Professors. I've been teaching at the U for 6 years. And I'm here today to say that in its current form, PELRA does active harm to thousands of workers at the U. I am one of them. I hold a PhD in my field and teach hundreds of students each year with distinction. Yet because of PELRA's mandated bargaining units, I'm classified as staff rather than faculty, and my job is defined by precarity. I work on unstable, short-term contracts for pay I have no power to negotiate, and to be clear, it is low. There are over 1,500 contingent faculty like me at the U, and we are asking for our basic rights as Minnesota public employees to determine our own bargaining unit. PELRA currently denies U of M workers that right. Worse, it warehouses us in illogical and impossibly large groups that block paths to unionization. To explain, I'd like to direct you to the document in your packet titled Bargaining Unit 11. Please take a moment to find it. When you've got it, I'd like to say welcome to Unit 11. This is my bargaining unit, the result of the current statutory requirements under PELRA. I would call your attention to the fact that this is a two-sided document. It's hard to read. You may need to squint. But the reason for that is because Unit 11 consists of more than 5,600 workers in no fewer than 199 job categories. To have a union, I would need to organize thousands of HR, IT, marketing, research, student services, and athletic staff, the highest paid of whom earns over $1 million a year. One group you won't find in Unit 11 are the tenure-track faculty who teach down the hall from me. They are in Unit 8. We do the same work, yet we are prohibited from bargaining together. Units 11 and 12 are both absurdly bloated, even as union-represented units are whittled away through the manipulation of job codes. In total, Pell relieves 23,000 U of M employees with no plausible path to unionization. These statutory bargaining units are anomalous, unnecessary, and unjust. They are out of step with peer institutions around the country. They are needless. PELRA already has rules for determining appropriate bargaining units. Finally, they deny labor rights to a vast and crucially important sector of public employees. Only the legislature can amend PELRA to solve this problem, and I urge you to do so. University of Minnesota workers are here today simply asking for the right to form common sense unions if we so choose. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you for your testimony. The next I have, and I understand these two want to come up together, Jeff Ettinger and Manny Vang. And I'm going to pull another chair over. Ed, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Jeffrey Ettinger. I'm the interim president at the University of Minnesota, and thank you, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here today to speak about House File 4508, a bill to modify the public employee definition at the University of Minnesota. We have been gathering data in order to address the requested fiscal note, and we will also want to consider other operational implications to the university. The University of Minnesota actively supports a positive and respectful work environment for all of its employees, both bargaining unit and non-bargaining unit faculty, staff, and students. Whether through collective bargaining or our shared governance structure, we enjoy multiple connections with all of our employees to regularly seek feedback on issues of importance. In recent years, some of these issues have included system-wide strategic planning, numerous COVID-19 pandemic policies, public safety challenges, student mental health initiatives, compensation benchmarking for faculty and staff positions, adjustments of salary floors for student workers, an expanded employee assistance program, and much more. Let me be clear, the university does not wish to prevent employee groups from organizing. In fact, the university agrees that a review of PELRA is due, given changes to the overall work environment and the needs of the university. However, any changes to PELRA must ensure that the university's workforce is able to fulfill our mission of teaching, research, and outreach. In our view, the best way to move forward is for the university administration to work in close collaboration with the employees and shared governance partners who would be impacted by any changes. In fact, this is exactly the same way it was successfully done in 1980 to create the statutory definitions of bargaining units that we have now. The challenge with the proposed bill as it's written, as well as the pace that this bill seems to be going through the legislature, is that it has the potential to lead to unnecessary complexity, conflict, litigation, and administrative burden. For example, while we agree that units such as the current PNA grouping may be unduly large and cumbersome, the bill proposes no limits at all as to how small or numerous future bargaining units might be. In addition, as has already been mentioned, the bill opens the door to the inclusion of undergraduate students on work study, as well as student athletes. A discussion on this latter issue has barely begun on a national level, yet the proposed new PELRA would open the door to this. My responsibility, like any good public steward, is to properly discuss all of the potential impacts of a change to PELRA with the university community and conscientiously evaluate what this bill might mean for the future. I appreciate your time today, and with the chair's permission, I would like to invite Manny Vang, our Senior Director of Employee and Labor Relations in the University's Office of Human Resources, to share some further comments on the potential effects of the bill.
Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Manny Vang. Thank you, Chair Nelson, Interim President Ettinger, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the bill before you today. The proposed bill changes may read as simple, but there are deep and complex implications for the university, many of which cannot be predicted at this time. It is challenging to fully describe what the impact of the bill would be due to the ambiguity around how different employee groups may or may not choose to organize, whether those employee groups may or may not be successful in their unionization efforts, and what university response would be necessary in light of the variability and complexity of each separate organizing process. All of the assumptions that we took into account will be in the fiscal note, but here are some that I would like to highlight for you. We anticipate the need for additional resources to support an initial influx of petitions, as well as the longer-term management of additional bargaining units by Central Human Resources, including labor relations, compensation and classification, employee benefits, retirement, payroll, and human resources management systems. We also anticipate a significant amount of leadership and administrative support will be needed to inform, advise, respond, manage, and facilitate very time and labor-intensive processes, as negotiating new contracts can take anywhere from 12 to 18 months per contract. And then finally, we anticipate a significant impact on our shared governance structure, which has a reputation as one of the strongest and most active shared governance systems among large research universities. In fact, the University of Minnesota is the only Big Ten institution to include civil service and academic, professional, and administrative employees, our P&A group, in its University Senate governance system. As the number of bargaining units increases, there is the potential for the representation of our employees in shared governance to decrease, thereby also making consultation on important issues facing the university all the more complex and time-consuming in order to confer with so many different employee groups and structures. These are just a few of the many examples of the potential ramifications we anticipate with this proposed bill. We appreciate your consideration of our desire to engage directly with our employees and our shared governance partners to determine the best course of action moving forward. I thank you again for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list will take questions after all the testifiers. Is Ian Regenberg? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ian Regenberg. I began working at the University of Minnesota in 2013 as an academic advisor. That job is what brought me to the state I now call home. While I've been grateful to work with exceptional students and dedicated instructors for the past 11 years, I've found much that I wish to change about working conditions on campus, from staff working second jobs to supplement low salaries to insecure annual contracts that give employees no protection from unscrupulous supervisors. Seeking to improve the situation, in 2015, I found a group of other staff and faculty on campus who were organizing to address these and other concerns. We signed union cards with SEIU Local 284 and talked with our coworkers to do the same. And that's when I first had to learn about PELRA. You see, I'm a Unit 11 P&A employee, meaning under the current law, I can't organize only with workers doing similar administrative counseling and instructional work with students, but I instead have to organize with over 6,500 staff in comically different jobs spread out across five campuses. Under the current system, I'm categorized as a P&A employee with athletic director Mark Coyle, but not with an entry-level advisor who may do nearly identical work to me. I believe we have been, had we been allowed to organize like workers in nearly any other workplace, public or private, we would have a union today. Since its creation in 1980, P&A positions have grown from 6% of the university's staff to over a quarter of all staff. And I should know, I served as chair of the P&A Staff Senate from 2018 to 2019. That's the same shared governance body that President Ettinger was just talking about. And while I'm excited to hear that they would like to involve that body now, when we were organizing in 2015 and 2016, we were told to strictly remain neutral and stay out of any conversation about the future of unionization among our staff unit. The bill before you addresses the absurdity of an employment group that has acted for 40 years as a catch-all for positions as diverse as IT professionals, optometrists, accountants, and athletic coaches, and allows university staff to pursue organizing with their coworkers, as I believe PELRA initially intended to make possible. I encourage your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Zachary Shaheen. Welcome to the committee, and I hope I didn't butcher your name too badly.
Thank you.
Say your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Zach Shaheen. I am speaking in support of HF 4508 to represent the interests of my residents and fellow colleagues. Our University of Minnesota is home to approximately 1,000 residents and fellow physicians every year. All of us residents and fellows have terminal degrees. We are doctors. We are training to be specialists called residents, many of whom go on to pursue additional subspecialty training called fellows like myself. I'm in the final year of my training as a pediatric rheumatologist. I have both an MD and a PhD degree, and as a physician scientist, I'm currently developing both a long-term clinical and research program. While I don't often like saying this out loud, I'm in my 15th year of explicit training after college. For my pediatric patients, I simply explain I'm a 31st grader. it hurts to say it loud sometimes, too. I would like to highlight two important points. First, we residents and fellows provide direct patient care in clinics and hospitals of almost every major health center in the major metro area. We lead public health and research efforts with the singular goal of making Minnesota a healthier place to live. We are privileged to serve our Minnesota community, and I'm proud of our University of Minnesota's mission and to be a part of it. Second, we are employees, but we lack the ability to negotiate our salaries. We work sometimes 70 to 80 hours a week, but we lack control over our schedules. We are faced with incredibly difficult personal decisions, such as deciding whether to defer starting a family or commit to having an unsustainable work-life balance. As a father of two kids, I can testify how tenuous that is right now. Our goal today is not to highlight specific grievances or desired work protections. We simply request the ability to collectively bargain, which is currently unobtainable for us, as you've already heard. The current bargaining units delineated by our state statutes do not lend a voice to our unique needs as physicians. There's a saying that doctors make the worst patients, and I find this assertion to also be true for our lobbying efforts. Our inclination, our desire, is to spend our professional time caring for our Minnesota community and being the best advocates to our patients we can possibly be. Our own needs are almost always prioritized later. And those of us in white coats here today, we've been lobbying our state and sometimes federal governments for years on a range of different health policy initiatives. But today is the first time that I can recall myself ever coming before a legislative body asking for help for us doctors. And over 20% of residents and fellows have already signed our written testimony also provided to you today. We humbly ask that you, all of you, provide us the tools that we may better advocate for ourselves. Please support the future of Minnesota medicine by supporting HF 4508. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Tyler Blackman. Welcome to the committee. Again, state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members and Chair Nelson. My name is Tyler Blackman, and I am a third-year law student at the University of Minnesota. And I'm here to urge your support of these PELRA changes and to provide just another example of a worker who is caught in the legal morass that PELRA has become. I currently work as a legal research and writing instructor, which means it's my job to teach first-year students how to write persuasive legal briefs. My colleagues with the title Legal Project Assistant also serve as teaching assistants for other courses, as research assistants for professors, and admissions ambassadors for the law school. We have overwhelming support for our union. And if we were in the private sector or even any other part of the public sector, we would have one. We would already be well on our way toward bargaining collectively for our first contract. Unfortunately, the outdated language of PELRA makes that impossible. As written in the 1980s, PELRA would force us to come to a collective contract with IT professionals, curators of museums, medical residents, and the director of athletics, just to name a few. I personally pass out at the sight of blood, so I have no desire to know what it's like to be a medical resident. I love a good Gophers football game as much as the next person, but I don't think anyone in this room wants me teaching our football players how to throw a pigskin. The groups of workers that are now arbitrarily lumped in together by statute simply do very different work, and we require very different contracts. This legislation would modernize PELRA to fix that problem, and importantly, would prevent us from needing to come back to the legislature every few years to recategorize these hundreds of different jobs at the U every few years. Because they're not speaking today, I also just want to put in a plug for our undergraduate workers as well. Right now, undergraduate workers can bargain collectively for a contract, but only if they don't need any kind of financial aid or work study. As someone who was a low-income student who very much needed financial aid as an undergrad, I find this odd at best and discriminatory against low-income students at worst. It's especially important that this provision be updated as well. Thank you for your time, and I urge your support of these changes.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have is Sandra Sharia, and I hope I didn't butcher that too badly. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me today. My name is Sandra Shariar, and I am here today to speak in favor of HF 4508. I am a third-year PhD candidate in the Department of Biomedical Engineering at the U. I work in Dr. Chun Wong's laboratory working on biomaterials for drug delivery. At the University of Minnesota, graduate assistants are represented by UMN Glue Local 1105 of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers. When I was admitted to the PhD program, I was given a three-year College of Science and Engineering fellowship offered to incoming students from underrepresented backgrounds who have outstanding qualifications. During the academic year, I am paid through this fellowship funding, whereas over the summer, I was paid through my lab as a research assistant. I am passionate about the important work that I do as a graduate fellow. Under the current PELRA statute, my work during the summer as a research assistant is considered a bargaining unit position represented by my union. However, my fellowship position over the academic year is not even considered by the university nor the law to be employment at all. During summer months, while I'm funded as a research assistant, I work on the development of polymeric biomaterials that can deliver medicines to biological systems. My duties include polymer synthesis and characterization, equipment upkeep, waste disposal, management of harsh organic solvents, training new lab members, and supply ordering and restocking. It is exciting and innovative work. During the academic year, when I'm funded through fellowship, I go into work every day in the same lab with the same supervisor, conducting the exact same work duties. The only difference is that the university and PELRA do not consider this to be employment in any way. I am outside of the bargaining unit and do not have access to hard-fought protections gained by our union. I lack recognized access to our grievance procedure. I can be made to take unpaid work-related training, and there is little recourse if I am told to work far above 40 hours per week. Thousands of other graduate workers are in the same position that I am. We conduct research, teaching, service, and administrative responsibilities much the same as other graduate assistants, but because of a technicality in PELRA, we lack collective bargaining rights. HF 4508 would rectify this by explicitly recognizing fellows for what we are, graduate student workers employed by the university to further its research, teaching, and service mission. More than 1,500 people have already signed a petition in support of PELRA reform, demonstrating the need for legislative action. I ask you to join graduate assistants, undergraduate workers, resident fellows, staff, faculty, and unions across the state in supporting the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And before I go to questions, is there anybody else that needs to come down and speak very shortly? Is that a yes or a no? Or I can see.
I'd be fine testifying.
No. Oh. With that discussion, members' questions. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Jordan. I just want to thank all the testifiers for coming, specifically Mrs. Holcomb, as well as President Ettinger, and also your service to the university. you know, I received an email with some, you know, good information. So I do appreciate you sharing that with me. I'm sorry we couldn't connect beforehand. But one thing I did take away from this was there is a shared commitment that this needs to be looked at. There is a need for that. So I'm hopeful that Representative Jordan, you're willing to continue to work with stakeholders to look at that. There's a variety of, you know, employment opportunities at the U for people. So, you know, looking at all those different ones, I think will be really important. So thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. Yes, the bill's being laid over so we can continue to work on it. And I appreciate that no one testified against this bill today.
Representative Myers, any other questions? Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for perhaps the author, Representative Jordan. Just curious as to, would this bill be, I would think this bill would be necessary to go to Higher Ed Committee, Chair Pelosi's committee. Why wasn't that the case in the first place or second place?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That committee waived their need to hear this bill. It is a power bill. It is firmly in the jurisdiction of this committee.
And as power, that would be yes. And if you're saying he waived it, that's why it's not going there. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's fine. That makes sense. See, I think Mr. Ettinger did state that perhaps they were not necessarily in favor of the bill, or I heard that nobody was opposed to this, but Mr. Ettinger, maybe if you would come down and clarify that, please.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Ettinger.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative McDonald. Our issue really is one of process. So I was up here. We have a lot of things going on at the Capitol. We were here 2 weeks ago talking about the state bonding bill, and when that hearing concluded, I was informed that in 2 days there would be a hearing at the Senate Higher Ed Committee on this Pelra bill. It was the first we had heard of it. You heard the testimony that when this law was created, it was created in collaboration between university administration, union officials, the other faculty and staff members that are part of the consultative process. In this case, we received no input on it. I've talked to the heads of the faculty senate and our P&A senate officials. They were not involved in the input. They received no notice of it. Agree that after 40 years, the law needs to be changed. We don't agree that it needs to be changed just in a few weeks and with no consultation.
Representative McDonough.
Thank you. Thank you, President Ettinger. I appreciate that. Certainly got to know you well and being on the Higher Ed Committee. And we as lawmakers have a bad habit of doing that, passing legislation or introducing legislation without asking really all the stakeholders kind of their opinion, especially the interim president of the U would be kind of an important process, I think. So the question then, last question, Mr. Chairman, is to Representative Jordan. What is there something that the unions can do for these folks that the U isn't already doing? I think the University of Minnesota has established a reputation of treating all of their staff and team and employees to the highest degree. Just curious as to, is this necessary?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, and I will just say for the record that I have met with the University of Minnesota and Minsky System Schools about this bill. And the bill is necessary because right now in Pelra, there are people who, like particularly undergraduates, who are barred from being in a union in our state statute. The other thing I would say is that because of the way bargaining units are written into our state statute, where there are mandated bargaining units here, that does necessitate the law change because people, as you heard from all the testifiers, are trapped within these unions. I mean, these are people that you heard from today that are asking for this bill to be changed and they outlined, I think, very starkly why the law is written in a way that prohibits them from, or not either prohibits or makes it very difficult for them to organize across the bargaining units that are established in Pelra. So, yes, this bill is very necessary.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Jordan, thank you. I have no issue with giving people the right to group and decide what they want to do and collective bargaining. I just wanted to ask the question what the U wasn't doing for these folks that the union can do better or not necessarily anything at all. That's all.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. You know, unions do a lot of things for workers. And if workers are not actually able to be in a union, they don't have that voice on the job. They don't have a shop steward to meet with to help them work through grievances. They don't have the ability to collectively bargain with people who have like jobs. They don't have a voice where they can talk about what they're going through with their hours. If they're working 70, 80 hours a week as a resident and not allowed to have any input, and they're not able to have that input because they don't have union representation, unions bring a lot of really good things to workers. We hear every day in this committee from people about what their union does for them and how it makes their job and their lives better. And that's what these workers are asking for. And right now they have to come to us to be able to even do that. And so we need to get out of the way and let these workers attempt to organize and fight for the jobs that they desperately want and love doing. And they want that representation on the job to do it.
Representative Donald. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I did not indicate whatsoever in any of my talk that unions don't have a place and don't offer valuable information. I know full well what great things do the unions do for the trade unions as far as safety. But I'm curious, if someone is working that long of hours and have grievances that there's no one at the U that they can come to unless they have a organize a union, there's a problem there in that case if we don't have that.
Ms. Holcomb.
Thank you for welcoming me back up. I appreciate the question about what can a union do that isn't being done at the university right now. I also appreciate the sentiment that the U is expressing intention and interest in working with employees. But I feel a great deal of urgency to jump in because the answer to that question is that people are poor. My colleagues are on food stamps in the summer. They have PhDs, they have master's degrees, they have MFAs. They give their lives to this university, to their students. They work unspeakably high numbers of hours for no pay. When I end this semester in May, I will receive a letter saying that I have been terminated from the university. I will lose my health benefits over the summer. I make $38,000 a year as a full-time instructor at this university. I can only do this job because my husband can compensate for the lack of income that I contribute to our families. Our university leadership knows these things, or if they don't, there is a question as to why they don't know what their own employees are paid. They have known this for a long time, and nothing has happened. As is always the case, it is the responsibility somehow of the oppressed to do their own heavy lifting, and that is what these groups of people here are here to do today, is to stand up for themselves and work out a system by which we can expect fair treatment for hard work well done at a university that we love. That is all I have to say.
Representative, we don't have a loud clapping or signs, so please keep decorum so we can continue with the committee. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, you stated earlier that if they get any level of financial aid, they are barred from organizing, I believe. Is that correct?
Representative Jordan, and I believe that was part of your testimony, but yes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and if you can give me a second, I can find the line where we do that. Yes, I would go to page 2.10 through 2.12, which is existing law that is struck in this bill. That says that full-time undergraduate students employed by the school, which they attend under a work-study program or in connection with the receipt of financial aid, irrespective of number of hours of service per week.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, I'm surprised to hear that, actually. With the what passed last year, were, you know, free college for all under for parents making less than 80 for a single, would they all be lumped into that same category if they are getting any financial aid from that new program?
Representative Jordan, I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mecklen, I don't know the answer to that either, but this section is very important because I don't think anyone should be discriminated against about joining a union. I think that could potentially increase the number of students that are discriminated against by our law. And it's definitely that would make this section of law even more timely than ever.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, from the language that receives any financial aid, right? I believe what you said. I would think that if they are getting the last dollar picked up, no matter what it amounts to, that would be classified as financial aid, I would think. Have you not thought of that? I don't know. I mean, was that taken into consideration in all this?
Representative Jordan, and you don't know the answer right now before the when this comes back, you might want to look into that and find out the answer. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, that would be something to look into. But I think, yeah, if you are prohibited from being in a union because you get $1 in financial aid, I think that's a problem. And so I think the idea that anyone should be barred from being in a union because of their parent's salary, whether it's $80,000 a year or $81,000 a year, is a problem. We shouldn't be discriminating against people based on whether or not they receive financial aid.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Jordan, there was some testimony given today about just additional burdens that the university would incur with this bill. Do you have or are you working on getting us a fiscal note for this bill?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, I have worked on getting a fiscal note, and the due date for that fiscal note was yesterday, and unfortunately I didn't receive one. Hopefully one will be coming back to get a scope of what that'll look like.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that you love fiscal notes, so I know that that was nothing of your doing. Certainly it would be beneficial for our committee as we discuss this bill, and especially when we're considering what the cost might be both to the university and then ultimately that which might be passed on through to those seeking higher education, be they people who have additional public assistance as they go to school, or whether it is just the Minnesota taxpayers at large, to understand the financial implications of this bill. And so I look forward to getting that information, especially when we consider the high cost of goods, high cost of food that has been mentioned here today, that we want to ensure that we're not creating additional weight upon people going to school and the people across the state who have been directly impacted by too much government spending causing rampant inflation.
And Representative Schultz, I hope that this doesn't end up being someone trying to kill the bill with the fiscal note. We've seen that in the past where departments of the state, they don't like a bill, they'll put a huge number on it, and if it's a bill they like, they'll put a small number on it or say they can absorb the cost. Yeah. And that's called death by fiscal note. Hopefully that this isn't being set up for that. Yeah. Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will make a plug for always reading the fiscal notes. There is great information in those fiscal notes that you can then use to make fun of Zach Stevenson, which I think we all enjoy doing.
Yeah, we all will. Yes. Any further questions? If not, you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will renew my motion to lay over House File 4508 for possible inclusion in a future bill.
House File 4508. Laid over for possible inclusion. All in favor, say aye.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there's a vote.
That's right. Never mind. Some committees, they do that, and I forgot. Forget. Anyway, this is laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative fiscal note.
We'll have a short little break here. Our two authors are not here in the committee at the minute. What's that? Yeah.
Are we taking a break? Did you just sit up?
Can we get a break?
Can we stand up?
What?
Yeah. I mean, we stay in the room.
You and me. Yeah, these armrests are really far apart. What is it?
I don't see the,
what there should be is a required to work out the
Blue State Building Code. And welcome up.
Better today. And if the people that are here for the previous bill want to take your conversations out in the hallway, that'd be great. And welcome, welcome. Representative Kraft, we're waiting for you. The next bill we have on our agenda is Representative Kraft, House File 4242. And I will move that House File 4242 be re-referred to the...
I saw him say that.
I went the wrong page. Yes, I was looking ahead.
Climate and energy.
Be re-referred to climate and energy. Representative Kraft, if you, I believe you've got an amendment.
Yes, I do. Oh, wait.
The A23 amendment. A3 amendment, excuse me.
Is that me? No, he's on the A4.
Sorry, I'm getting over from another.
Well, I've got an A3 and I've got a. I see you got an A and an A4. Which one is yours?
Mine is the A3.
I'll move the A3 amendment to put the bill in the condition that the author wants. You want to explain, is this a technical amendment or?
It's getting it in the form in which I want to hear. There's a bunch of date changes, number changes, things like that. That's how I'll talk about the bill.
Okay. All in favor of the A3 amendment to put the bill in the authors the way the author wants it, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes. Now the A4, is that yours or is
it is not.
Okay. We'll get that after you explain your bill then. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing this really important bill. So buildings are responsible for 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, and residential buildings generate over half that amount. This bill is about addressing new homes by accelerating efficiency improvements in our state's residential energy code in a responsible way. The energy code is our tool to make sure that when new housing gets built, it is built right to maintain comfort, health, safety, and minimize energy waste. HF 4242, as amended, sets us on a path so that new homes achieve a 70% reduction in energy use by 2038 as compared to the 2006 code. It doesn't require one fuel type versus another or one insulation product versus another. It sets an energy savings target for the experts who update our building codes led by the Department of Labor and Industry. The 70% figure, which is one of the amendments made, was arrived at after modeling work done by experts at the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota to determine the limits of reasonable energy efficiency. By the way, later I have a real life example that I'll talk about that backs up this number. We already have this provision for commercial buildings. Last year, we passed very similar language that puts commercial buildings on a path to 80% energy savings by 2036. Another exciting part of this bill is a new rebate program for the highest performing new homes, those that are built to a net zero ready standard. And I want to tell a story about why I'm so excited about this. So a few months ago, I toured a affordable housing complex in Northfield, Minnesota, Hillcrest Village, 17 units, mostly duplexes, townhomes. They are net zero buildings. We spoke with the builder that built some of these, and the feedback was that it cost 7 to 8% more than current code. So 7 to 8% more. It's more, but it's not that much. We also learned that they were able to get a 62% energy reduction as compared to the current code. So if you put that in the context of the 70% we're aiming for, that 70% is relative to 2006 code. So we can see that building these types of buildings is already possible today. The really cool thing about these homes is that their energy cost on a yearly basis is $240. That's heat and electricity. So I think we want to encourage this kind of development, not just for the climate side of things, but just for affordability and the health of homes. So the zero energy ready home certification that we're incenting here in the rebate program is a certification from the US DOE, and it qualifies builders for a $5,000 federal tax credit as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. But certification requires professional energy raters, which tend to be more concentrated in metro areas right now. So by reimbursing these energy rating services, including travel costs for zero energy ready homes, we're making sure that this type of thing is available throughout Minnesota. And we're leveraging the money that's in the IRA to really kind of double that money in some ways. And we're rewarding builders and developers who are striving for the most energy efficient homes. With that, I have some testifiers.
I have a list of testifiers here. First person on my list is Eric Fowler. And welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thanks to the committee. My name is Eric Fowler. I use he, him, his pronouns, and I'm a senior policy associate on the buildings team at Fresh Energy. We're a nonpartisan Minnesota-based energy policy nonprofit dedicated to advancing equitable carbon neutral economies. I am grateful to testify in favor of HF 4242 because we need homes that sip rather than guzzle energy, and we need to build them that way from the start when it is much easier and cheaper. Most of the energy that we use to heat and cool our homes goes to waste. It leaks out the roof, it goes through windows, or it goes around a only partially sealed vent cover. We know that because of the reductions that are possible, 60, 70, 80% better than standard construction. We can build high performance buildings that can cut huge percentage of energy use with the techniques and products that are already available today. 80%. This bill supports better home building across the state without prescribing one product or fuel over another, and it simply directs the Department of Labor and Industry to advance in this direction. So it does this by using the International Energy Conservation Code. This is a model code that the Department of Labor and Industry essentially uses as a first draft. Our current residential code is an amended version of this, and we are about to adopt another amended version of the IECC for Minnesota. So we are already on the path. The next code update, so 70% energy savings. The next code update that we're already on track for should deliver about 30% energy savings. So we're already on the way. And as Representative Kraft said, the second piece, that rebate piece, by offering reimbursement for energy raters, it supports a growing workforce of those energy raters who play a critical role verifying building quality and educating builders on cost-effective energy conservation. How we survive and thrive in a changing climate starts at home with our homes. We have already guaranteed this quality and savings for commercial buildings, and I hope that we'll vote yes to give the same quality guarantee to everyone in Minnesota's residential buildings as well. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. We'll finish with our testimony, and then we'll go to questions. Right, next on my list, Barbara Moorhead, and the next person is Michael Moorhead. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members, and visiting guests. My name is Barbara Moorhead. I'm the owner of a very efficient home. Prior to building our home in 2016, my husband and I spent years doing extensive research on what it takes to build an energy-efficient house. It is my firm belief that education is the key to reaching an informed decision. Currently, Minnesota is using the 212 Minnesota Residential Building Code, and this was modified back to the 2009 IECC. Thus, we are currently using technology that is well over a decade old. The current code is supposed to be used statewide, but it is neither adopted or enforced in outstate areas due to the lack of resources. And then please refer to the handout, actually, in your, I believe you all, I do have colored ones too. So starting out, continuous outside insulation is the very most important improvement needed. This is the example I have is, these are examples from our house. Doesn't mean it has to be done that way. This example of ICF, or insulated concrete forms. These are blocks placed in Lego blocks and then filled with cement, and they are several types, sizes, these blocks. And this is just one example. There are other ways to accommodate continuous outside insulation. Next slide, or next photo, is rain screen. Using wooden slats on top of the house wrap, a rain screen can be created under the house siding, and this leaves spaces between the house wrap and the siding to allow moisture to escape. Energy heel truss. How many people have heard of an energy heel truss? We've got one. Okay.
I'm sure Representative Mecklen is also.
Two. Okay. These are trusses that are specifically designed, and you can see they're kind of left off on the picture, left off part of it. That allows you to insulate even more, so you can kind of prevent heating and cooling. Attic insulation. Adding insulation to your attic will improve your home efficiency by reducing heat loss. We put 42 inches of blown in, and we are so glad we did. Basement insulation. Adding additional geo foam insulation under your basement slab will provide ground moisture from wicking up and allow your basement to to be a lot warmer and drier. Window placement. It's crucial that you have window placement on the south side. If you have big windows, they should be on the south side of your house to allow gain from the sun. But you also have to remember where the sun is in the winter and the summer, so that you allow for that to happen, so that in the winter time, when the sun is lower, you're getting gain. In the summer, when it's higher, that roof extension prevents it from heating too much. Windows. Windows should have a good U factor. Many people don't know what a U factor is, but just so you know, it should be within standards. Many double hung windows tend to leak and do not meet those standards. Window and door bucks. A buck is what they put in your building to attach your window and your doors to. And it.
If you want to wrap up, so.
Okay.
We have other
okay.
testifiers and sure. We have limited time.
Okay. You can read the rest through it. My disclosure is most of the above mentioned examples do add some cost to the building of the house. However, they add much to the amount of energy savings associated with heating, cooling, and the comfort of your home. There are more examples, but I feel that these are the bigger items. That is why I support House File 4242, as it is in a step in the right direction, and we need it now. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Your attention.
The next person I have is Michael Moorhead, and then the person after that on deck is Nick Erickson. Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Michael Moorhead. You just heard from my wife about our Afton Passive House. She's described the house. I will describe other broader research. For years, I've done research. I will go straight to the summary on my letter to this committee. Massachusetts, New York, and to a lesser extent some other states have already passed building codes that far exceed what this bill represents. Massachusetts has a three-tier building code system, a base code followed by only a few, a stretch code which exceeds what you're being asked to look at today, and a super code which is basically passive house. Massachusetts is a home rule state, and each city can adopt the building code it wants. 90% of the cities in Massachusetts have adopted the stretch code. 59 cities have adopted the net zero code. Massachusetts is well ahead of us. New York has passed a similar home rule statute, which allows cities to adopt the code they want. And they found that, I have some statistics here, a city that adopts the stretch code, the average home will save $348 in energy costs annually. It will cost an additional $2,000 to build that house, and the payback is 5.9 years. Other issues that come up on a regular basis, the issues between the seven-county metropolitan area and outstate Minnesota. Outstate Minnesota cities and counties don't have the resources to build really super energy-efficient homes. They don't have ResNet providers. They don't have trained building inspectors. They need these people. The state of Minnesota, through a separate bill, can figure out a way to get these people what they need. Thirdly, prospective home buyers are absolutely ignorant. They come in, every year I go through the parade of homes, fall and spring. People come in and they're starry-eyed and they talk to them about upgrading the kitchen, your granite countertops, things like that. They know nothing about what a HERS rating is. I was in one last weekend. They probably displayed a HERS rating of 51. The HERS rating in my house was 9. Right? Home buyers need some sort of an education, a home buyer's bill of rights. Lastly, I would opt that the state of Minnesota consider home rule for all cities so they can pick the building code they want. I guess that finishes it. I'm open to any questions if anybody has any.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll take questions at the end. The next person is Nick Erickson, and after that is Sam Friesen. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm the Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota. Our members build the communities and places we all call home. Housing First Minnesota operates the state's largest energy-efficient new construction program, Minnesota's Green Path. We know a lot about building homes and building them efficiently, and that's because in Minnesota we are the highest efficient medium to high production state in the country. We are number one. And we want to thank Representative Kraft for working with us on this bill with a few concerns that we've had. The 70% move, something we are happy with, tying the adoption of the new energy codes with the current building code cycle to us is critically important. But we still do have some concerns I do want to highlight. I think first is we have a six-year code cycle here in Minnesota. Our builders do think that six-year code cycle is critically important. And, you know, we prefer to keep on that same trajectory. It's helpful for training and getting comfortable with the code. I think despite having an older energy code, we are still number one in Minnesota, and having the ability to work and become familiar with the provisions has allowed us to retain number one for as long as we can. And I think there's just some more clarity I think that we'll need to work through the technical team at DLI, but just to put it in perspective, I sit through a lot of code hearings, and smaller homes, while they are more affordable, it's really the missing middle type of housing we need to be building, they are disadvantaged from an energy code perspective. It is simpler to build a more efficient home by simply doubling the volume. So there is a few concerns we have about how the energy savings can be accurately identified with a smaller home, just because you double the volume by building a basement, or triple it by building a basement and second story, that triples the volume of the home. It's easier to get a more efficient home when we are doing that. So there's some concerns that we wanted to highlight. We continue to work with Representative Kraft on this as it goes forward. And I'll just stick around for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Sam Friesen, and then Jamie Pitsky is the next person. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Sam Friesen, and thank you, Representative Nelson, for letting me join you this afternoon. I'm a builder out of Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I traveled down last night, and because I think this is an important bill and something important for the state and as a, through the broad public. I've passed in the past. I've served on the Northern Minnesota Builders Association. I'm active on every job site every day. I've been building with my hands for the last decade, and I'm very well aware of what it takes to build high performance and the differences between a regular house and a high performance house. Our experience, we started upping our standard wall systems about 2 years ago, and our experience is that we are increasing, I would say on the highest side, we're seeing about a 1%, and right now we've got wall systems we're using that are a zero. Absolutely, it's just a wash. The way we're able to do that is I included a drawing from a wall, but we basically just make, it's really simple. I mean, and you know, Minnesotans love common sense solutions. So what do? We make the wall bigger, just like a 2x6 wall. We have stronger materials, we can take some out, and we can reduce our labor. It helps us. We have huge labor shortages in rural Minnesota. I'm sure you guys are hearing about it all the time. It helps us on that side of it because all of a sudden we reduce the number of assemblable parts by 30% while only increasing the number of board feet by 10%. We're able to get a tremendous local timber. That 10% I don't see as being an issue. It's pretty low cost difference and it's offset by all of our labor. My experience is that, you know, while people talk about continuous insulation and all these different wall systems, you know, there's a standard 2x6 wall that everyone's familiar with, and then there's ICF walls, there's continuously insulated walls, there's externally insulated walls. Those are all steps better than your standard wall. If we stick to wall to wall, standard to standard, there really is very, very minimal costs, if any, and it's helping our project flow on most of our job sites right now. So you know, other aspects of getting more efficient houses, triple pane windows, we're seeing an 8 to 10% return on investment on those in northern Minnesota. You know, we're always a little bit colder than you guys are, so that's probably modestly better for us. But you guys get the heat in the summer, and you can keep the heat in the summer, too. That's all right. So, you know, bottom line is a lot of these are just smart business moves. They're smart building moves. Just like we don't ask every client or every homeowner that, you know, how do you want your roof structured so it doesn't collapse? Well, we come up with standards, and because they're good investments for the owners and they make sense, and we don't expect everybody to be educated on every aspect of homes. So if there's any further questions, I thank you for your time, and we can follow up later.
Thank you for your testimony. Jamie Fitzy. Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, Representative Kraft, and Labor Committee members. My name is Jamie Fitzke. I'm Director of Government Affairs at CenterPoint Energy. CenterPoint Energy believes all Minnesotans should have access to efficient, affordable, and reliable heating, especially during the coldest of temperatures. This includes hybrid heating systems. This is typically an air source heat pump that is paired with a natural gas furnace. Hybrid heating systems consistently provide the least cost option for home heating. They have great resiliency, particularly in our coldest weather. I do have some supplemental information here because I might kind of go down a little bit of a technical rabbit hole in case members would want to grab a copy of that or if it could be handed out. Because I'd like
to have a page. You can get to the page. You can get.
Thank you.
And then you continue.
And thank you for that. And this will probably help kind of connect the dots to where our concerns lie. So specifically in this bill, it states site energy as a requirement. And this is in direct contrast to what the IECC says and will constrain residential heating options. So our request would be to have line 3.14 through 3.15 stricken, which states requirements must be adopted such that electricity only and mixed fuel buildings attain the same site energy use intensity. So issue one with this is the IECC has three compliance options: prescriptive, performance, and energy rating index. Site energy language essentially eliminates the IECC prescriptive code compliance option for Minnesotans, which means then Minnesota home builders could no longer choose that as an option. So then you're left with two options. So our second concern would be then with the performance compliance option, IECC explicitly mandates either you're using an annual energy cost or a source energy intensity, not site energy intensity, as this bill would require. So I know right now you're looking at me, site, source, what are you kind of talking about? I think a good example for this would be that with an air source heat pump and you're looking for a backup heating system, you have two options right now. One would be an inefficient electric resistance system. It's kind of like heating your home for a backup with a curling iron or a toaster, essentially. So that has a site energy efficiency of 100%, but source energy efficiency of 33%. If you have a gas furnace as a backup, then you have a site energy efficiency of 90% and a source energy efficiency of 85%. So that's where a lot of our concerns lie within this bill, is specifying or having then the requirement then of site energy. So this is why we would request that those that line be stricken on 3.14 through 3.15, as it will end up constraining residential heating options in a state that faces some of the coldest and harshest weather conditions. We hope that the author would take would consider this change, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Any further testifiers? Seeing none coming down. Questions? I see Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kraft. Kind of coming, number one, I'll start by, I think there's some exciting stuff in terms of technology that will get us to a place that's more efficient. You know, I love the premise to begin with, efficiency, affordability, and reliability. I think that those are really some rallying cries around, whether it's this bill or our more global topic around energy right now. I wanted to just kind of follow up on the testimony that we just received and see Representative Kraft if you have an openness and a willingness to strike lines 3.14 and 3.15 as suggested in the last from the last testifier.
Representative Kraft.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. So I'm open to discussing it, but there's another side to this as well. One is that the current code, the way the codes are done, actually favors fossil fuel appliances. And I can, as a subsequent, provide data that shows how it does this. The site energy use makes it kind of technology neutral. And there's also a point that on the way it's done, so the EPCA, which is the Energy Policy and Conservation Act, which is the thing that authorizes DOE to promulgate minimum efficiency standards, that statute defines energy use as the quantity of energy directly consumed by a consumer product at point of use, or in plain language, as site energy use. So I have maybe a difference of opinion here on what is doable and not doable. I'd also say that on the comment of hybrid heating systems and the importance of them, I actually will agree on that, especially if you're talking about existing homes. I mean, in my own home, we looked at how do we evolve to a heat pump solution. And because of the lack of efficiency, it was built in the 1950s, that you can do in an existing home, needing a hybrid heating solution can make a lot of sense. But in new homes, and I think I have the great example of these homes that I toured in Northfield, they can be made so energy efficient that the costly thing is requiring to put in a second fuel source when it's not necessary.
And now, Representative Schultz, I'm going to go to Representative McDonald. You have an amendment you want to do. We'll get that out of the way.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I thought it would be good to get the bill in the author's proper request. Of course, you're not requesting this, but thank you. It's a good one, I think, though, Representative Kraft. I think you'll agree to this. On page 5, line 7.
Do you have a copy of the amendment?
I know the amendment.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, delete $100,000 and insert 8%. Basically, the administration fee. It seems that's a little high, but this is your bill, Representative Kraft. You know it better than I, although I've been, digesting it here for the last couple of days. But the administration fee is over 16%. And certainly it costs money to administer the program should this become law.
But that seems a little bit more excessive, especially when you consider a lot of the other nonprofit groups and other organizations that have usually a 5 to a 10% administration fee. So my amendment would just bring that down to 8%, which is around $48,000 to administer. Seems like plenty ample money to implement this with Dolly.
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair.
Succinctly.
Yes. And Representative McDonald. So this is going to be done by Commerce. It was part of the amendment. And I appreciate your focus on this. It's something I'm concerned about as well. The problem is, given where we're at, I would love to provide a bit more money in this kind of a bill, but at providing $500,000 or $600,000, $48,000 is not enough to do it. So I'm going to recommend a no vote for it. But if I'm able to provide more money at some point, then I'm absolutely open to the kind of direction you're suggesting.
Representative McDonald.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fair enough, Representative Kraft. And that's, like I said, your bill better. It certainly seems high. In speaking with the Department of Commerce, is this what they suggested, that it needs to implement it, or could they work with a little bit less?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't yet have the fiscal note back from the Department of Commerce.
And members, this is going to the Energy Committee, so.
Yeah.
Representative McDonald, do you want to move your motion?
Yes, I move my motion.
Representative McDonald moves the A4 amendment. Representative Kraft, you said, what's your pleasure with the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd recommend a no vote for the reasons I discussed.
Members, all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The noes prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Schultz, go back to your questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to get this done by slightly after 2:20 so we can get to the next bill.
I'll be as succinct as possible. Thank you for your comments, Representative Kraft. I hope that you continue to work with stakeholders to find the route to ensure that we're hitting those marks that I talked about earlier. My only other question, and frankly, Mr. Chair, you might be best to answer this one. I apologize for not knowing it, but when is the next date of when the next building code updates would go into effect?
There's a gentleman, I don't know the date. Being retired from the carpentry, I have not kept up with that. But.
No.
Welcome back to the committee.
Strangely.
Nickerson's Housing First Minnesota. Yeah, it'll be around March 2026 is when the codes are going up. There's some, work with the revisor's office on a specific date, but generally they try to target March of 2026 would be the roughly time. Be scheduled.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just encourage the author of this bill to work in a way that allows this to be more streamlined and not create additional cumbersome burdens for those involved.
And Representative McDonald, do we take care of the amendment? Is that why you put your hand up, or do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Representative Mecklen, you have it on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of questions, and I know that the chair would like to keep this moving, but is there anything prohibiting all the testimony we've heard of, all the beautiful things you and I have talked about, SIPSOMs in the past? There's a lot of things we can do to build very, very efficient houses, but is there anything prohibiting anybody from doing that now, especially when you take into account this will add cost? There's no way around it. I've built a lot of these, and for those that can afford it, that's great. But it seems to run kind of counterintuitive that you're pushing another bill to create more housing more affordably when you're at the same time saying we're going to make it more expensive. And especially with the inflation we have on building products right now and the increased interest rate, at what point, I'm concerned what point this would take some of those lower income levels and completely eliminate them from having the opportunity to own a home. And when you take all this, and furthermore, this is usually stuff that the Department of Labor works on as they kind of come through things. I don't know that I agree with some of the testimony we heard, because we've been implementing far further energy efficiencies as much as we can advise people to, if they can afford them, because long term, especially a younger couple, they have time to have a return on investment. But is anybody prohibited from taking on any of these many measures that you've talked about now?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mecklen, no, there's nothing that prevents anyone from doing some of these advanced measures. In fact, we're going to incent some of it. The reason that that we're doing this and doing it in this way, right, is to provide a certainty of here's the direction we're going to minimize any additional costs. It's trying to do it the most responsible way. And the fact that right now we're seeing, you know, net zero homes being able to be built at 7 to 8% more than the current cost says that by providing that certainty, we can get to that point at a minimal additional cost. And by the way, that additional cost means you wind up with a $240 a year energy bill. So, you know, I'm looking at the overall cost to live in a home.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know about the 240 cost. I've built many of these things over the years. I have many friends that have lived in them. Yes, they are extremely more efficient, but I don't know that they can get quite that low, but depending on the size of the house. I mean, that's just reality of what we live in. And especially with specifically the cost of energy going up, electricity going up over the last several years, because my electricity has gone up and I use way less of it. But if you, again, when you say if it's 6 to 8%, the average house right now is about 350. If someone give me a head nod, up it's higher than that now. So four, whatever. So you're talking $32,000 more just to build that house. On just that example, now you take that, you add the 8% mortgage interest rates for it, you take all the other fees that come along with it. For every $1,000 you increase that price, you are knocking off many, many buyers or eligibility. So I find it very counterintuitive. You're basically saying you want the legislature to mandate building code, energy code, when that's what we have the entire Department of Labor to do. And I appreciate it because I literally wish I had this particular hearing 2 weeks ago, because I just took my continuing ed and we're required to do 1 hour of energy. I just got mine. But at the same time, I find it might be very counterintuitive when this all can be done for those that can afford it, but for those that can simply not, and what we typically refer to as a starter home, you are going to price, you could very easily price these people right out of the ability to even own a home. So if you would take that into account going forward, I think that is something that needs to be discussed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On the next person I have on the list is Representative Myers, and then we're going to come to a vote. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft. You know, I think we all want to support those hybrid opportunities so that we can ensure, you know, there's a balanced approach to home ownership, you know, our environment, the rising cost of housing, you know, and energy concerns. And, you know, we saw some bills last year, I think, that are going to make that even more difficult. But a question I had for you was, you know, when I read this bill, And you made a statement that there's houses that don't need a hybrid approach or they can handle heating themselves. Can you give me examples of that?
Representative Kraft.
Yep. Mr. Chair.
Quickly.
Yeah, Representative Myers. So, yeah, Hillcrest Village in Northfield.
Representative Myers.
Okay, so what I will lead in on that is, you know, we live in Minnesota here, and I just find it hard to believe that these communities alone can be able to, you know, not, you know, continue to heat their house as we deal with, you know, the winters, the falls that we have, you know, which leads me to, you know, kind of read between the lines a little bit, is that we're trying to move people away from a hybrid approach when I think we're one of the most efficient new home states in the country, if you look at that. You know, my hope is that you continue to work with stakeholders. You know, I learned something new today about bumper plants from somebody that was here, that you can look at, you know, putting those sources of heating, you know, where the electricity comes in, maybe not at an individual home, but, you know, what I see from this approach again is you're really trying to take away those opportunities for people to have that choice. So hopefully you can keep working on this.
And Representative Kraft, if you want to do a quick wrap-up, and yes, we'll get to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Myers, what you just said was just not true. This bill does not preclude a hybrid approach. It is not fuel-specific. If someone wants to do a hybrid approach, it's fine. But I'm just saying that if a home is built in a certain way, it doesn't necessarily require one. We have many homes in Minnesota today that are built like this that doesn't require it, and so why should we force that expense on someone? So I'll say that. The other thing is we have a climate crisis, right? So this is something that we need to deal with, and this is doing it in a responsible way. We are not forcing people to build a net zero home today. In fact, we're not even forcing them to do that by 2038. right? This is trying to set it out so that this is where we need to go in the most cost-effective manner possible. I was merely showing that example to say, even today, when we're not, we haven't laid this out, we can build homes that don't cost that much more than code today. So thank you very much. This is a great bill. I ask for your support.
And I'll renew my motion that House File 4242, as amended, be referred to the Climate, Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The bill's on its way. Motion prevails.
Nice job, man.
Sort of a... And next, the last bill we have on our agenda is Representative Mokamot. And Representative Mokamot, if you guys want to be quiet as you leave, so we can get on with the next bill. Representative Mokamot, this bill. Representative Mokamot, this bill needs to go to the general, going to the general register. So you want to make the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion to refer House File 4661 to the General Register.
Representative Wolkamott, do you want to explain your bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to present House File 4661,
and
which is the...
Can I stop you there? Do you want to do the amendment first to put it in the right order?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I would move the...
It's the A24-0249.
Well, I would ask the committee to move that amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it, simply reflecting the recommendations from the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council.
So Representative Wolkamott moves the amendment, the A24-0249. All in favor of that, to put it in the right order, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment's on. And I understand this is the Workers' Comp Advisory Committee's annual bill. Representative Wolkamott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for your support on that amendment. Again, I'm here to present House File 4661, which is the technical policy bill for the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. In the interest of time that we have 2 minutes left, I will truncate my presentation. A little bit of background on the WCAC. Is a unique creation of the legislature that exists to review and recommend changes in the state's workers' compensation laws. The WCAC is made up of legislators from both parties, including myself and Lead McDonald, as well as members from the labor community and the business community. So none of these recommendations can move forward without support from everyone involved in workers' compensation. And I'm proud to share that this bill has support from the Department of Labor and Industry, as well as the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier to further explain the nuances of House File 4661.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jessica Stimmick, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry. This bill is introduced, and the proposed amendment before you today adopts recommendations made by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council for amendments to Minnesota Chapters 176. Representative Wolkamott is one of four legislative liaisons assigned to the council, along with Senator Uckey, Representative Wolkamott, and Representative McDonald. The Workers' Compensation Advisory Council is a statutory labor employer council that negotiates reforms to the work comp system before recommending a consensus bill to the legislature, the goal of which is to improve the work comp process for businesses and injured workers. This bill and amendment were unanimously approved by the Work Comp Advisory Council and include proposals from the council's labor and business caucuses, the Work Comp Bar, the Department of Labor and Industry, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and the Work Comp Court of Appeals. It contains 38 sections with amendments to Chapter 176, many which are technical or cleanup provisions. The bill is introduced and the proposed amendment before you, or sorry, the accepted amendment before you, include statutory clarifications and updated references as recommended by the Office of Administrative Hearings, technical changes to certain provisions in Chapter 176, clarifying rulemaking authority for the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Work Comp Court of Appeals related to electronic filing, certification of electronic signatures and interventions, describing when employees can be referred to DLI's vocational rehabilitation unit for certain disputes, clarifying attorney access to workers' compensation claim documents and DLI's technology system, revising the calculation of average weekly wage for short-term agricultural workers, adjusting the maximum dollar limit on workers' compensation attorney fees, amending the calculation of maximum weekly compensation for temporary total disability benefits, describing notice requirements for discontinuation of voc rehab services, specifying a penalty for charging in excess of statutory allowances for electronic medical records, raising the allowable cost for remodeling awards for permanently and totally disabled employees, updating the penalty amount for violations regarding required notice and payment timelines surrounding the benefit discontinuance process, and finally, changing the time allowed for filing an answer to a claim petition. Thank you for letting me get through that. I appreciate it, and I'm available for any questions.
That anybody else in the audience need to testify in the bill before I go to questions? Seeing no one jumping up, questions of the bill. Representative McDonald, as a member of the Work Comp Advisory Commission, do you have any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, I approve it. It's a good bill, and I thank the whole team and Representative Wolgamott for his leadership, but really the whole team of the Workman's Comp. They work very hard. They do the heavy lifting. I certainly do not. Maybe Wolgamott does, but I doubt it. So they get full credit for this good bill. Right, Representative Wolgamott?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, you got that right.
Any further questions of the bill? Or discussion? If not, you want to renew your motion as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 4661 as amended be referred to the General Register.
That's the amendment, or that's the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
And with that, members, we are adjourned.